And a good Sunday evening, everyone. It's June the 28th, and welcome back to Seth's Basement. We're using the NXT Report music from the NXT UK Report No Spots here tonight for a little bit. It's Dan the Seth, your host tonight from the basement in RVA, and we've got a big show for you tonight. Tonight, we do the concluding chapter in the top 90s films you have to see before you die. And I even have a best of the rest of films that are good, but didn't quite make the cut. We've got some major Q&A to break down. I have a stimulus update. And you know, I'm a little sick and tired of Hollywood and their nonsense trying to be remorseful of what they do or don't do. All of this on a crazy night here in the basement. So let's get this started, shall we? That's right, folks. We are at the cream of the crop, if you will, in the top 190s films you have to see before you die. We've explored through a lot of films, mainstream, independent, all types of genres. But these are the films that I strongly suggest the most. Now, before we break into the top 25, there were five films outside the top 100 that just missed the cut, and I call them the best of the rest. Number one, Pulp Fiction. I'm going to get a lot of shit for this, I know. But Quentin Tarantino's second film is just greatness. But like with the rest of the other four films that join it with this part of the list, the nostalgia just isn't quite there and just misses out on the top 100. I do suggest you watch this film as well as the other four films outside the top 100 at least once, though. Number two, Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers. Yes. This frustrating film made the cut. And why? Well, it books in the Jamie Lloyd trilogy in a nice little bow, if you will. And it has one of the best masks and one of the best Myers portrayals and also some of the best atmosphere as well. Oh, and after this most recent rewatch, which was about a week and a half ago, it stands with the original Halloween 2 in rank. Number three, The Big Lebowski. I'm a big fan of the Coen brothers. Everyone knows this. I am a huge Coen brothers fan. But this case of mistaken identity just misses the list just slightly, okay? It's a fun watch and a solid one, but the nostalgia just misses. With me, folks, tis all. Number four, Crooklyn. Spike Lee, some events in Spike Lee's youth growing up in Brooklyn is the plot of this one from 94. It's a solid coming-of-age drama, and the soundtrack is basically 70s music from Spike Lee's childhood, except for the title track, Brooklyn Dodgers, comprised of Buckshot, Master Ace, and Special Ed. I like this film as it was part of Spike in his actual life. Just doesn't hold back with nostalgia, that's all. And five is a comedy concert movie. Y'all know I love Eddie Murphy Raw. Well, Martin Lawrence, You So Crazy. Think of this as a 90s Eddie Murphy Raw, where race relations, sex, family, relationships, childhood, everything's on the table here. This was kind of like a way of bidding adieu to his stand-up and going to what he would do with Martin, what he was already doing with Martin, but also his film career as well. And the irony about this one is that it had the rating of an NC-17. So Miramax sold the rights to the film. They didn't want to carry that with that or an unrated or without a rating. So the Simon Golden Company picked it up and released it unrated, and they still made some pretty decent money off of it. So there you go. And now without further ado, we hit into the top 25. Coming in at number 25 is Casino from 95. Now, you know, this was actually the late, great Black GOP's favorite film, and it's very memorable to say the least. It involves the story of the Chicago outfit when they ran parts of Vegas before the corporations took over. You see, folks, before the corporations came in the 80s, Vegas was ran basically through the mafia via several different outlets and organizations. Reasons to watch this classic. You've got a great cast. You've got great writing. Scorsese, one of his best directorial efforts here. A shame that he didn't get Best Director, but tis is. And some of the frames of violence were edited out to get an R rating, as initially this film was facing an NC-17 from the MPAA. And if you don't like the graphic violence, there's always the romance, the marriage storyline. There's scenery. There's a kick-ass soundtrack in it. And you also have the parts where Daenerys is playing Ace Rothenstein, Sam Rothstein, and Ace is trying to tell this guy who's a local yokel how to do his job as a slot tech. That is absolutely hysterical. All in all, though, solid film. Casino, number 25. Katara is here with us, and she'll be happy to know that at number 24 is Interview with the Vampire from 94. Now, Katara knows this. The network knows this. A lot of people that have known me since childhood know this. I'm a major Anne Rice fan, and the Vampire Chronicles were amazing books. Now, this was adaptation was met with a lot of controversy because of the casting of Tom Cruise's Lestat. And at first, I wasn't on board with it. I was thinking Rutger Howard would be a better pick. But when Anne Rice came out with a statement, she had seen the final cut about a week before the film's release and said, you know, Tom did really well. Go see this. I was like, all right, fine. And I actually liked it. Now, what's this film about? A reporter in San Francisco does an interview with Louis, who's been a vampire for 200 years, and you end up with a tale of drama, remorse, death, and horror. And for you Twilight fans, you're going to get triggered by this, but these vampires don't sparkle during the daylight. They actually die. Yeah. Coming in at number 23 is the 1994 indie classic Clerks. Now, this was Kevin Smith's directorial debut and was originally rated NC-17 because of the graphic language, but on appeal, thanks to Alan Dershowitz and as well as Miramax execs, they got it re-rated R. And this film was modeled after Do the Right Thing from 89, which was on our 80s list. You have two clerks, Dante and Randall, and one works at a video store. Randall Graves works at the video store. The convenience store, which is next door, Dante Hicks works there. And they interact with bizarre customers all day, and they deal with personal issues as well. It's a funny film, but very relatable. Have you ever worked in retail, food service, customer service? You know, that neck of the woods? Yeah, that's why it's so relatable to me. Sadly, though, yeah, we've got to come into the shade department here. Kevin Smith's career post Clerks 2 hasn't been all that great. You know, Zach and Mary was a disappointment. Cop Out was, not sure what was going on there. Red State was okay. But the Jane and Silent Bob reboot, which I watched last night on Amazon, that was atrocious. But his career, you know, I'm looking forward to Clerks 3. Hopefully that'll help resolve things. At number 22 is The Hunt for Red October from 1990. This was the film based on the 1984 novel by Tom Clancy about an analyst and CIA author, Jack Ryan, when a Russian submarine with a silent driver Caterpillar goes missing. There's a fear that the captain and his crew want to start a war with the United States. However, Jack Ryan has a theory that he has to prove. The captain and some of the crew want to defect to the United States, so he has 72 hours to prove the theory, or else the orders are to sink the Red October. This was a solid adaptation of the novel, and honestly, it's the closest to the source itself where it comes to Clancy's work. It's a film that doesn't get old, but you have to remember the disclaimer in the beginning. Both governments denying these events ever happened. Katara, how are you this evening?
I'm okay.
I've got some good news for you. I'm going to allude to this in the Q&A, but we got some much-needed rain today. It felt really good.
Well, good. That's a good thing.
Yeah. Okay. Now we're at number 21, and here's where we start cheering, because it's Lethal Weapon 3. Okay, this is the installment from May of 92, where Riggs and Murtaugh work with an internal affairs investigator into a rogue former cop who's involved in a gun-running scheme and has armor-piercing bullets that go through bulletproof vests. This is where you get Lorna Cole. you know, the sergeant from Internal Affairs, this is where Leonard Cole comes into play. You get Leo Getz, and the cool thing about Lorna is that Lorna becomes a love interest for Riggs. Unique stat here, though, and Katara loves when I have these stats here. Katara, this is the only Lethal Weapon film where Murtaugh's house and family are not in danger. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yes. Now, mind you, when Leo is trying to sell their house, he tells the people they're going through the house, you know, all the damage from Lethal Weapon 2. You know, when you had the bomb with the South African triad and everything, you know, that all that stuff. But it's really funny because it's the only one where the family is not, where the Murtaugh family is not in present danger, neither is the house. That was pretty cool. All in all, it's my favorite of the three sequels to the original. And I'm hoping that if we get Lethal Finale, that it just wraps everything together. Although I thought the ending of 4 brought everything together. That's beside the point. We're getting into the top 20 with Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. And I can hear Katara saying, oh, dear God, no. The Michael Myers, James Bond spoof that, honest, it still gets a lot of laughs. When Dr. Evil falls out in 97 after 30 years, taking nuclear weapons for ransom for $1 billion. It's up to a thawed Austin Powers. He's just stuck in the 60s mindset to stop him. It's a funny movie, and there's a way to watch this film if you aren't thin-skinned or triggered by the fact that the title character is a womanizer and a total flirt. Okay? It's a love story you will for the James Bond franchise. It's a film that never gets old. It's honestly what I call the heyday of Michael Myers, film star, because he got his start in film really with Wayne's World, and that did pretty well. Wayne's World 2, but Austin Powers kind of put him on the map as like, okay, bankable film star for a couple of years, until Shrek Forever After, but then Love Guru came out, and after that, it's been kind of downhill for him. But they're looking at a fourth possibly, but no, don't do it, Mike. Number 20, Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery. Coming in at number 19 is the prison dramedy Life, starring Eddie Murphy and Martin Lawrence. When two guys from New York are framed for the murder of a card shark in Mississippi as they're spending the night after bootlegging some moonshine and liquor, they get sentenced to life in a prison camp to perform hard labor. It's a film that I saw opening weekend. It's easily quotable, but also teaches a lesson, though. People come and go, but people that stick by you through the hardest of times are the people you want through your life. Yeah, Ray and Claude have falling outs during the film, absolutely. But they usually come back around, though, and I love the ending to this film. I'm not going to ruin it, but the ending is just, it's good. Wraps everything up. Katara's going to like this one. Number 18 is The Last Supper from 95, which I've told her about. Now, I've discussed this film before with the top 100 films you have to see before you die, and it's worth the discussion again. When 5 grad students in Iowa kill a violent dinner guest with extreme right-wing views, the film goes into the play Arsenic and Old Lace, where in this case, people are poisoned if their far-right views aren't changed with wine laced with arsenic. However, the mind of match with a conservative talk show host. Kind of, the best way to describe Ron Perlman's character is kind of like the antithesis of a Rush Limbaugh back in the day. Kind of like that. Now, as everyone knows, love these films, and this is when I cut on VHS because I bought the film Heavy Metal, and the trailer was attached to this on VHS. So I rented it, laughed my ass off, and bought it when it was available at Suncoast. Okay, which for those of you who don't know, Suncoast was a video store inside of a mall that sold videos, laser discs, posters, etc. What it did was it took films that when they were getting onto the selling market, they would get those films and put those out for sale. It's a black comedy, but very much in the top 20 of 90s films. Coming in at number 17, Clint Eastwood makes an appearance in The Line of Fire from 93. This is the crime thriller where Clint Eastwood plays Secret Service agent Frank Horrigan, who tries to stop a former CIA agent with an assassination attempt on the current president. Horrigan is still has haunted of guilt and issues because he didn't stop the assassination of JFK to boot. Now, Katar knows I'm a big Clint Eastwood fan. He's one of the greatest of all time acting-wise, and it's hard to argue that this film doesn't live up to its expectations. It's well-paced, it's well-timed, it's seamless. It's 2 hours and 8 minutes, but it passes by quickly as opposed to some films that are over 2 hours that tend to drag on endlessly. 16. Coming in at number 16 is Hot Shots, starring Charlie Sheen, Lloyd Bridges, John Cryer, slew of others. This is the Zucker Brothers doing a parody of Top Gun, but then taking it and branching it out to other films, ranging from 9.5 Weeks to The Fabulous Baker Boys, Dances with Wolves, Gone with the Wind, just a whole bunch of stuff here. When Topper Harley is recruited to come back to the Navy as a pilot, his mission has a lot of problems. He ends up to cope with being about in his dad's shadow. A woman happens to be his shrink who he has a crush on, or interest of his team, etc. Saw this in theaters, and like with every Zucker Brothers film, you stay for the closing credits too. It's typical Zucker fare, but if you saw Airplane and Top Secret, you'll like this one. But my favorite part is the parody of the Fabulous Baker Boys were in this lounge. And then, you know, the song starts off with it, then Topper takes off and then just steals the show and gets one of his colleagues really pissed. It's really funny, though. Coming at number 15 is the aforementioned Dances with Wolves, which, in my view, the last great Costner film, okay? For people who don't know, I did not like his take on Robin Hood. I thought that was horrible. Okay. Waterworld's decent. Bodyguard's really good. Grand Theft Auto's pretty decent. But Dances, about the best you're going to get from Kevin as far as his performances go, top rank. He plays a Union Army Lieutenant John Dunbar, who rediscovers himself while on a military post in the American frontier and dealing with the Lakota tribe. Here's another stat for Katara and all of you to hear. There's a 4-hour director's cut on DVD that has all the deleted scenes from the theatrical cut that was 3 hours and 1 minute long. It's a good film, very seamless, but I don't suggest the director's cut in one sitting because it's 4 hours long. It's long. Coming in at number 14, The Bodyguard from 92, the aforementioned Kevin Costner's in this, and Whitney Houston, rest in peace. This is the story of a former member of the Secret Service who's hired to be the bodyguard of a musician, and how they end up falling in love. This film is honestly a surprise hit of sorts. It was jammed-packed with Aladdin, Home Alone 2, Few Good Men, and limited release, you had The Crying Game, you had Reservoir Dogs, and it was a jam-packed marketplace. And I know that a lot of critics hate this movie, but honestly, I actually love it. It's not the best Costner acting job, but it's showing that Whitney Houston had acting chops, as well as being one of the best musicians in my time of Generation X. Coming in at number 13, pushing off a button here, Dogma, the fourth Kevin Smith film, which stars Alan Rickman, Chris Rock, Ben Affleck, and Matt Damon. This is the controversial story about two angels, Bartleby and Loki, who are outcast angels who find a loophole to get back into heaven. Katara, there's a caveat to this. You know that, right? There's always a caveat to something like this. Here's the caveat. If they pass through the gates as mortal souls, the world ends. Yeah. So it's up to Jay and Silent Bob working with a divorcee, Bethany, who's Catholic and works in an abortion clinic to save humanity. Okay, this film down death threats on going to Kevin Smith from people who are like, oh, God, you're destroying Christine. You know, no. It's worth it. It's a good film. Not as fun as Chasing Amy. Not as groundbreaking as Chasing Amy, but it's much better than Mallrats. Mallrats was okay, but this is much better. And speaking of a few good men, that's at number 12. You've got Tom Cruise, Kevin Pollak, Jack Nicholson, Kevin Bacon, Demi Moore. In this drama, based on the Aaron Sorkin play of the same name, a group of Navy JAG lawyers investigate and help defend two Marines accused of murder as they are accused of murdering one of their own in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The defense, they were ordered to carry out a code red on a PFC because the PFC had written a note to the NIS about a fence line shooting. This is a terrific movie. And it shows a lot of growth in Cruise's character of Lieutenant Daniel Caffey, as Caffey was used to plea bargains and not trial law. It's a solid drama. You have a few laughs in there. They're very few and far between, which is a good thing, but it's a good movie nevertheless. Katara's going to start smiling because 007 makes an appearance. GoldenEye, number 11. And here's something that I don't know if Katara knows or not, but Katara, did you know that there was a 6-year absence in the Bond franchise because of legal issues?
There's a what?
Legal issues. That's why Timothy Dalton only did 2 films. Because by the time he came up with GoldenEye and started to produce it, his contract had ran out. So that's how we got Pierce Brosnan in the role of Bond. And now you know. Okay, 007 comes back with a bang. Mm-hmm. And this is a major rush into the 90s. There's a deadly satellite system that ends up in the wrong hands, and it's up to Bond to save the world from impending disaster. And here's where I start laughing. James Bond having to adapt to the PC culture of work and learning that his treatment of women isn't exactly right in the 90s. Man, that was something else. Because I saw this opening day in the theater, and all I thought was, wow. James Bond having to learn to be politically correct in the workplace. This is a new one. Because I'm used to the fraternizing and flirting of Bond. But it worked, though, okay? And as I said, this was the start of Pierce Brosnan as Bond. And he was a good Bond, okay? He was also in Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, and Die Another Day before the series got its reboot with Daniel Craig. This was also the start of Dame Judi Dench's M. Yeah. All in all, it kept with my tradition of enjoying Bond films in the theater. It's one of my favorite 007s, which we will have a countdown after I see No Time to Die in November. Mm-hmm. That's already penciled in. Coming in at number 10 is Toy Story. Yes, Toy Story. Disney, they really got into a bit of a hot streak in the animation department before 95. You had Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King. Those were all solid hits for Disney. But this is where Pixar came through. This is where Pixar starts and Disney animation becomes the cream of the crop, if you will, Pixar. When Woody's replaced as Andy's favorite toy by Buzz Lightyear, he's a spaceman. There's first a rivalry, then resentment, but when both toys get lost, they have to work together to come home. This never gets old, and I didn't really enjoy the sequels as much as the first, but this was the start of things, though, because until the beginning of the 2000s, kids were saying, okay, if it's not Pixar, I'm waiting to see it when it comes home on video. Let me say that again. Kids were very choosy. They were going Pixar or bust at one point. Very good. Number 10, Toy Story. Coming in at number 9, Silence of the Lambs. Now, this is an oddity. And here's where Katara loves this right here. Katara, what is regarded as Oscar season to you? The Wing Wild,
no
that
idea.
December 31st is the... Okay. Here you go. Usually Oscar season is late November through all of December, because December 31st is your cutoff and it has to show in one theater by December 31st. This was released on Valentine's Day of 91. So it got all, ranked up all these Oscars for a February release the next year. It's just amazing to me. This is the story of FBI, at the time, FBI cadet Clarice Starling, who's investigating serial killer and needs to get the help of imprisoned cannibal killer Hannibal Lecter. Yeah, cannibals in this one, folks. Now, this film honestly took what was a lesser-known film, Manhunter, and blows the lid off of the Hannibal Lecter franchise and film into the mainstream. Now, one of the big differences here, you hear of depictions of cannibalism in the film, but in the book, it's graphically in place. It's a classic. It's not appropriate for the kids, but it's still a solid watch. Coming in at Crazy 8, Katara. Did you ever watch Desperado or Once Upon a Time in Mexico?
Nope.
Ooh. Well, for those who did and are missing out on this one, I don't know what their problem is. El Mariachi. Mm-hmm. Our soon-to-be hero. All he wants to do is play the guitar, which is the family legacy. But El Mariachi's got a problem. He gets mistaken for a killer, so he has to use the guns and a guitar case that he receives to survive and take down the drug lord and his subordinates trying to kill him. Now, the drawback that some people are going to say about this film, Sith, it's all in Spanish. So what? Okay? So you're going to be reading subtitles for an hour and a half or so. But it's still an amazing thriller. You know, if you saw Once Upon a Time in Mexico and Desperado, haven't seen this? Yeah, too. Lucky 7, Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino's directorial debut. Man, another film I saw at the old West Hampton Theater with the lousy seating and just in love from start to finish. Heist Gone Wrong film. And someone's a rat. And the question is, who's the rat? Is it Mr. Pink? Mr. White? Mr. Blonde? Mr. Brown? Mr. Blue? Or Mr. Orange? Is Joe, the boss, on the level as well as his son, Nice Guy Eddie? It's a simplistic film, and one of the strengths of this film is not only the backstories of Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, and Mr. Orange, but also the fact that you see the robbery being planned out and the aftermath. You don't see the actual robbery, and the conclusion actually makes sense. Not going to spoil it, but you got to watch this movie. Coming in at number 6, as we look outside the top 5, Boys in the Hood from the summer of 91. John Singleton's directorial debut. This is the film about Trey Stiles, who, after another fight in elementary school, is sent by his mom to live with his dad in South Central LA. It's a coming-of-age drama that's gripping, and to this day tells the reality of life in some parts of the inner cities. If you pay close enough attention, you will see that this film was trying to bring people together and not apart, unlike what Dan Quayle and others on the extreme right tried to imply. All in all, it's a film that teens should watch before graduating high school, a major wake-up call. And yeah, this includes schools with mainly white kids as well. If you're white and you need to see a glimpse into white privilege, where it comes to treatment by police, this one will give you a major awakening. Number six, Boys in the Hood. We launch into the top 5 with Malcolm X, the 1992 Spike Lee biopic on the life and death of the African-American activist. This is one of the best films of all time, hands down. And it's also one of the most impactful films of all time. This film covers key parts of Malcolm X's life, from childhood until his assassination on February 21st, 1965. Now, I'm going to be very candid. The fact that this film was overlooked at the Oscars big time is a miscarriage. it's mainly wrong. Yes, I loved Unforgiven. It's one of my favorite westerns of all time. I loved Al Pacino's role in Scent of a Woman. But this film is very much overlooked. That's the thing about Hollywood. They're just now starting to pull back their covers a little bit and acknowledge great movies about African Americans or involving African Americans that are historical. They're only starting to scratch the surface with it. 92 weren't ready for it. They weren't ready for that discussion. And I believe in some circles, they never will be. If you haven't seen this movie, you damn well should. Number 5, Malcolm X. And I promised Dennis Leary would appear again in the countdown, Katara. And you need to watch this over Christmas this year. The Ref. Okay, this is a Christmas comedy, okay? A lot of people go, oh, I'm going to watch Home Alone. I watch The Ref, okay? In this film, Dennis plays Gus, a cat burglar who breaks into a house for a jewel heist and ends up being trapped in the house, surrounded by a bickering married couple and a rebellious teenage son. This film, I watch it every Christmas season without fail. Whether I'm done with Christmas shopping or I'm just in the mood, I'll find it and watch it, okay? If you ask me, Seth, do you watch this or Home Alone every Christmas season? The Ref wins hands down. It's black comedy, but has a lot of crazy twists in it. And you get Judy David and Kevin Spacey as the bickering couple, which is good. You got Robert J. Steinmiller Jr. as the 14-year-old who routinely gets in trouble. I just love this movie. It's just absolutely hysterical. Number 4, The Ref. Number 3, Batman Returns from 92. Now, neat note for you all. This was the first film. Stat here for you, Katara. We all know about DTS Digital. Came out with Jurassic Park in 93. Batman Returns was the first film using Dolby Digital. It was just very rarely used from Batman Returns until they decided to make it more mainstream in 93. So there you go. Michael Keaton's last turn as Batman, at least for now, because he opted not to return for a third installment when Tim Burton got slid into the producer's seat instead of directing because Warner Brothers wanted a lighter tone after this one. And you get Catwoman and Penguin in this one, when Oswald Cobblepot, who was raised by penguins, comes back above Gotham. He and Catwoman try to take over Gotham together as a team. And you get the story that I like. Bruce Wayne courting Selina Kyle. And for those who complain it's too dark, oh, well, it's Tim Burton. What do you expect? Okay. But I will level with you and admit that this film was actually darker in tone than Batman 89. And for those asking, saw this initial midnight premiere and two other times opening weekend and once more before it left theaters. Love this movie. Number 2 is one of the greatest sequels of all time, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. As I pointed out when we did Star Wars Jurassic Park Terminator, saw this twice opening weekend on its own. Yeah, this film is amazing. Okay, what happens here is an adult John Connor finds out that Skynet sent a T-1000 model to kill a teenager, so the Resistance joins him in sending back a reprogrammed T-800, but reprogrammed him to protect John. This is just balls to the wall exciting from start to finish. Yeah, the nostalgia runs big time. And I can't ever think I could ever get rid of this one. I've had a choice to erase the film for good. And at number 1, Die Hard with a Vengeance. A return to form from the Die Hard franchise because it was something a little bit different. You know, Die Hard 2 gets a lot of criticism for basically being Die Hard at Dulles, but kind of the same premise. With this one, it delivers a lot of action and fun. Hey, Katara, here's a tagline for you that you only caught in your trailer. When the theater goes dark, the roof blows off. And guess what? It's right. Because after you get through Summer in the City and the opening credits, boom. Okay. John McClane's on suspension. Imagine that. He's hungover. Again, imagine that. He's estranged from Holly and the kids. Okay, imagine that. Okay. And ends up in a game of Simon Says and has an unwilling partner in Zeus, who's a shopkeeper, an electrician, you know, shopkeeper in Harlem. There's a catch to all this, though, as to who Simon happens to be. And honestly, it's a great bow on what was initially the trilogy. Okay. As much as I enjoyed Die Hard 2, Live Free or Die Hard, and to a much lesser degree, A Good Day to Die Hard, this one is the best sequel in the Die Hard franchise. And there you go, the top 100 films from the 90s that you have to see before you die. Next week, I have seen 31 Stephen King novel adaptations from story to screen. So we're doing worst to first, and this will include Dr. Sleep, which if you have HBO, it's on HBO now. Really good stuff. So next week, Stephen King. Time for some Q&A. We know that you're a lifelong libertarian. Yes, that's very true. Is there any candidate you voted for, though, outside the two parties that weren't a Republican or Democrat? Yeah, actually, as Katara knows, Nakia knows, the network knows, 92 and 96 voted for Perot both times. If you ask me, folks, Perot was a straight shooter. And as much as the Bush family despises him, it was Bush 41 going back on a promise in his 88 campaign that caused him to lose. I also supported Doug Wilder, who ran as an independent to be mayor of Richmond, Virginia. And he was the first African-American Democrat governor as well in the country. Again, I vote for the person who I think is qualified most for the office, not for the party itself. This one actually came from our good friend Jeff Canarsie. Katara, he sent us this one. Is Nirvana overrated, or were they inducted too soon into the Hall of Fame as a lot of greats like Stevie Ray Vaughan and others took what seems forever to get in, and Nirvana got in first year qualification? That's a good one. And we're going to lose a whole lot of people here when I say I'm going to leave that. Yeah. They did help grunge go mainstream, but I don't think they should have gotten in first ballot. I know a lot of people are going to be upset about that. Nirvana's good, but they weren't first ballot worthy. As much as I kid about having Tool get in, they are not first ballot worthy. At the end of the day, grunge will be known for taking glam rock and throwing it over its shoulder like an empty beer can, or because in a Thanos snap, glam rock was finished. The minute Smells Like Teen Spirit hit the mainstream, you had to either evolve or you're done. And the glam rock bands, save for maybe Metallica, didn't evolve. They just kept going, and they were erased quickly. I do like some of what Nirvana did. They're Unplugged as a top 10 of all time for that show. And Man in Bloom is a personal fave, but this could have waited a few years. Hell, it took Kiss a ton of sands to get in, or else they'd never be in. Sid, how do you feel about a soft reopening of theaters showing films from back in the day, and also how they're adapting things in this era of COVID? I like this idea. You see, folks, we've had to deal with a lot of films have been pushed back to late or early fall at the earliest. So it's nice to bring back some of the classics at a reduced price. You have certain films that are being shown for, you know, all showings of like $5 right now in places where theaters are open, where you're able to take in a movie or two from back in the day. Now, I know in this stage of COVID that some things won't be available in concessions, but again, even the concession people, from what I've heard, have done a really good job of adapting to things, so that's a good thing. And I have a request. Guitar News, I caught this in the 4K release in the theater of this, but I want to see it again in theater. I want to see the 4K release of Alien again in the theater. Ask me why, Katara.
Why?
I want to see the derelict ship again on the big screen in 4K again. Because that was something else. When they go into the ship, they find the eggs, and you see the space jockey. Because it's like the catalyst. Because once they get into LV-426, and they start exploring that ship, and you know what's going to happen if you've seen Alien before. It's just fun to watch. It was amazing to watch on the big screen last year. And I just want to see it one more time with the 4K remastering. That was awesome. Now, I was alluding to Katara with this earlier when she came on. Says, do you prefer the heat and humidity of the East Coast, especially the South, or the heat and low humidity of the desert, given you've lived in both environments? Damn. You know something? The only difference between the two places is simple. Down here in the South, out here on the East Coast, we get rain that's either because of the heat and humidity of the day, which adds a steamy sauna feel, or the cold front if it's potent enough, some major storms. In the desert, you get the rain basically fall to winter, starting in monsoon season and going through about February or March on average. And the summers are blazing hot, but without the humidity. I'd stay here on the East Coast, down here in the South, because as much as I love the desert, I want to break from all the heat, although the drawback is the humidity. You know, as I told Katara when she came on, we had that little bit of a cover, if you will, that dust that they were talking about. And I'd gone outside to get some work done this morning, came back inside. I'm like, let it rain today, at least for a little bit. About 3:15 out here. Nice big shower. But the catch about this wasn't a cold front, so it just added to the mugginess outside. But it's all good. At least we got a little bit of rain. You'll love this one, Katara. Do I have any regrets or predictions that I make on this network? What do you think?
Say that again?
Do I have any regrets of predictions that I make on the air? Whether it's True Talk, No Spots, Hertz House. You're right, I don't. Because get this, y'all. They're just predictions, okay? No one knows what's going to happen down the road, so you take your best guess with the information you have available. I don't care if it's football, wrestling, politics. I don't have regrets at all in my prediction game that go wrong, nor do I wish that any of them not come true that came true. Because, you know, I was just telling you the information that what I had. I can't control that the Redskins did what I said they were going to do at number two and get Chase Young and didn't trade back for more picks and try to get Chase Young then. And didn't force them to do that. Nor did I force, you know, 50 million people to vote for Donald Trump so he could win an electoral college either. I'm not responsible for that. All I did was give you all my predictions based on the information and based on my knowledge of history. That's all. It's a lot like blaming the groundhog for a late blizzard. Just get over it already. Oh, and it's not my fault that my pay-per-view picks have been crap of late either. But that's just the game of predictions. That's all. Sith, let me pick your brain here. Okay, sure, no problem. Do you think that if you get a second stimulus through, as well as infrastructure, does that help Trump? Look, I don't know how many times I'm going to say this, but I'm going to say it again. 30% think, fuck this dude, no matter what happens down the road. 30% think he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Oh, and both sides would gladly take another check for $1,200, despite their actual feelings about Trump and or stimulus spending. The 30% that love them, even though they're complaining and screaming that, nah, you can't do this again, they'll gladly take the $1,200. And the people that hate him will begrudgingly but thankfully accept the $1,200 but not vote for him. It's just how the cookie crumbles. Look, if it gets on board with and helps with everything that makes sense, such as rental assistance, renewal of unemployment with incentive to return to work eventually, a second round of checks, and then in a separate bill, infrastructure, it might help them with the 40% that are pragmatic. You have to take in mind this virus hit out of the blue, no matter where you believe the origins are from. The best thing to do in this case is to get things fully in place, but also make sure the relief is there for those who need it most. Now, that being said, as I will mention in the stimulus update, I am against the $4,000 credit for travel. I'm against that. We have rising cases in Florida, Texas, California. I'll explain that in a few minutes, though. Someone wants to know why I'm so anti-QAnon. Look, I'm not against the movement, but I'm against some of the people that are in or related to the movement that have honestly have this pent-up idea that, oh my God, we have all these indictments, we must have arrests now, or else I'm not going to be happy. Well, keep waiting. Keep waiting. Because what I've studied from the boards from the last 3 years, they say it's going to take place, but then it's going to take time for that to actually transpire. It's not something that's going to happen tomorrow. There's a Q drop tonight that I've missed. It's not going to tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. Period. Goes like this. Odds are, if you're looking for mass amounts of arrests based on, as of June 1st, 172,401 sealed indictments, you're going to likely get them after the election. If Trump gets reelected, and it's anyone's guess, I think he will, but that's just because I know how polling's done. It'll be soon after November 3rd when you start seeing these arrests. Yeah, I'm against pay-a-why triot. These are people that use QAnon or Trump to make a quick buck. And you have people on both pro and anti to do this constantly. You have people like Ann Coulter and Alex Jones who were in love with the guy, but because they haven't seen arrests yet, they cry and bitch about him and they still make money off of him. And then you have people that are QAnon that run pay sites as well. I'm against them as well. And I don't buy into Frank Kelly's murder was QAnon related. That was done for an insanity plea. It's called I killed a mob guy. I need a way to cop out. Quick, let me put QAnon. That'll get me out of trouble. Please. This is a question from the tweet bag, of course. AOC put out a tweet that was deleted after 20,000 retweets pleading for states not to reopen or else Trump would get reelected. My thoughts on that? Wow. I saw that tweet and a question came to mind. Is this really a virus or about a 4-year election? Now, like Trump and others on the right, AOC is a part of the left that you have to dissect what they say on social media and start asking yourself, did they or not really mean what they said? I would think that her statement is about the elections and not so much the virus because she slipped up and said, keep the economy closed because Trump could get reelected if it reopens. Flip side, though, is that there are a lot of moderates that are more concerned about public safety. I think that Florida and Texas did the right thing in their course correcting with the surges with the states again. But again, safety first, bring the economy back and the people back to work gradually as conditions allow. And yeah, there are people that are on the right that you have to dissect, including Trump. So AOC is not immune to me dissecting stuff. I do that with Trump all the time. Seth, my favorite shit-talking British musicians. Oh boy, here we go. Look, our friends across the pond have been known to give us a lot of great musicians, but some of them have a habit of being very outspoken. So here goes my top four. Number one is Morrissey, and guitar knows I love Morrissey. Okay, she'll come to me, send me some, go, Dan, your boy's at it again. You better come get him. Hey. Okay, look. He doesn't stop offending people. He's been outspoken like this since the 80s on things ranging from his view on people eating meat to the royal family. Okay, I get it. People get offended by it. but it's damn entertaining. Oh, and he's a constant target and hits on someone else who's on this list as well. Yeah. Number two, Johnny Rotten, known as John Lydon, the former lead singer of the Sex Pistols, as well as the frontman of Public Image Limited. He's very outspoken, is known to rant on things big time, and he doesn't hold back. You're likely to get your feelings hurt when it comes to politics, where it's British or American, the royal family, the state of life in itself. And if you dare interview him and mention the Sex Pistols, but not mention Public Image Limited, he will gladly correct you and put you in line real quick. See, Noel Gallagher. Noel Gallagher of Oasis. No one is safe from Noel's wrath, not even his own brother, Liam. They've had a running feud for decades. He's like a younger Morrissey, and his rants crack me up. I mean, he's so brutal. And he doesn't give a damn. He's very much off the cuff and very politically incorrect. You just got to deal with it. And the guy that shoots at Morrissey and he gets shot at, Robert Smith of The Cure, is number four. It doesn't matter if The Cure's frontman is shooting on British politics or even at Morrissey nonstop. They've been rivals since the 80s, folks. It'll never end. Okay? You have better luck of Harry and his wife and whatever kids they might have. You have better odds of them coming back in the good graces of Buckingham Palace than you do for Robert Smith and Morrissey to make amends. Not as blatant as the listed above, but still very much on topic. He can talk some shit. Seth, how do you feel about Parler? Would you join yet another digital platform? Look, I might sign up for Parler, given that I love social media platforms of late that allow different views. But Parler, to me, is essentially a right-wing version of Twitter. A lot of people that have joined Parler have been either shadow banned or outright banned from Twitter, or whatever the case may be. I do know people on Twitter that do have accounts on Parler that after the election, they're going to go to Parler for good and leave Twitter, and that's their choice. I will likely, if I join Parler, stay on both just so I can keep an eye on things. You know, I'll probably sign up with Parler, but after the election, I'll keep up with Parler so I know what other people are saying post-election. So there you go. How do I know so much about the oversample of Democrats? Well, it's a case of not thinking, it's knowledge. Nate Silver of 538.com on election night 2016 admitted when asked how come his shift to Trump winning only happened 3 years after the polls closed, and he admitted he oversamples Democrats in his polling data. If you get a chance to read into the polling percentages of Democrats, independents, and Republicans, most polls have at least an oversample of at least 8 points in favor of Democrats over independents and well over 15 over Republicans. When you use that sample, it's going to be easy to give Biden up by double digits. Okay, now if I were to flip the Republicans with the Democrats and keep the independents where they were at the middle, I could get the same thing for Trump, at least 8 points, you know, the Trump up by double digits. And just how the cookie crumbles, and it's something I've known for quite a long time. You know, it's how when I look at Rasmussen, they have a +4 in favor of Democrats when they do their polling. How it's much tighter. Well, because it's a little bit tighter where it comes to the three. That's all. Sith, did Michael Moore have a point to not sleep on Trump again this year? You know, he's the first celebrity to sound the alarm, and rightfully so. No one saw Trump winning in 2016 until it was all over. And we're starting to see that parallel again, where people actually believe that Trump is going to lead a landslide to Biden, and that Republicans are in for hell in the Senate, etc. I get the idea that we need a best or worst case scenario, but we've gone through this. The lone indicator will be on election day, November 3rd, 2020, where there'll be a silent majority, as Trump has alluded to, or where Biden and the Democrats have a blue wave that crushes the Republican Party. All of this will be answered on November the 3rd, and until then, we can just speculate back and forth. Last question is wrestling related. When did I become a wrestling fan? Was it before or after the Attitude Era? Well, before the Attitude Era, my friend. My fandom began with pro wrestling back in around 83. This was where he still had the territories Vince had bought with Titan Sports, the WWF, from his dad, but he hadn't started buying out his competition yet. Okay. I started to watch Georgia Championship Wrestling on TBS because I had cable, as well as Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. Both were affiliates to the NWA at the time. My exposure to the WWF happened in 84, just before the Vince Black Saturday, where Vince bought Georgia Championship Wrestling and got the 605 to 805 slot on TBS. The time I liked the most, but because I liked the entertainment value of the WWF back in the day, but I loved the wrestling themes in NWA, later WCW. Stimulus update before the rant and before we close things up as well. Congress is getting ready for yet another two-week vacation starting on Friday. Now, I know what you're thinking, but Sarah, Seth, Dan, didn't they just take a few weeks off from Memorial Day? Am I Patrick? A few weeks off from Memorial Day? And in my Patrick Bateman voice, I say, yes, they did. There's your American Psycho reference, folks. You see, this is one of the perks of being a member of Congress. You get so many days off for vacation to go back home and talk to your constituents that honestly, the amount of days you're actually in session with Congress is about 140 days, if that. So there is that perk if you're doing, that you're doing minimal work for definitely good pay. So what's the latest on second stimulus? Well, the White House has come up with a number for their idea, and it's basically trying to meet Congress in the middle. The House Democrats who passed the HEROES Act were looking at $3 trillion. The Senate Republicans are looking at $1 trillion. The White House is looking between $2 to $2.4 trillion. And the White House is also looking in a separate bill for infrastructure, which is something both parties will really love. Infrastructure will be a separate bill, but it will be in with states reopening as it will be a boost to employment. And let's throw in a nice little catch. Trump said Tuesday that he's for second round checks and he's the word generous as well. So I'm going to tell you all what I think will happen along with what I want to happen. I think that there will be a second round of checks for the same income levels that got checks the first time. That means $1,200 checks to those making up to $75,000 if you're single, $150,000 if you're married, and the same drawdown limits to $98,000 single, $199,000 if you're married. I would extend the benefits to dependents from $500 to $1,200. Not a guarantee that that'll happen, but that's what I would do, and it's something that House Democrats have proposed in, with their passage of the HEROES Act. You have a new outbreak right now as we speak, and this money could be crucial for some households. And also, if you're 16 or 17 and you're working, you qualify for the $1,200, in my view, because these kids have car payments and stuff like that. They could buy their own clothes. You get the idea. If you're considered adult dependent, meaning you're a college student or you're on disability and a family member claims you, I support the idea of you getting not only $1,200 for the HEROES Act, but retroactive CARES Act, which would be $2,400. And as I said, if you're 16, 17 and working, I support it. I would refuse the $4,000 rebate if you go on vacation. I know that POTUS wants to give his buddies in the hospitality area a break, but damn, son, bribing people to go on vacation right now is not a good idea with cases spiking up. I'm just saying, safety first. I would extend unemployment benefits by reducing to $400 a week and offer a bonus for people who go back to work. Throw in immunity as well for employers as well as from legal action because they're going along the guidelines that the states used for reopening. And lastly, you need to fund states and local municipalities. This cannot be refused. Now, the odds of all this happening with a split Congress, snowball's chance in hell, but it's worth a shot. Get it done, Congress. And better yet, instead of going on another two-week vacation, stay in D.C. and get this done instead of kicking the can for a couple of weeks. Oh, and a stat. The first set of checks, $300 billion, and in the second round, they will need to make sure that it goes out to the living only and not the deceased. Qatar, did you see that yesterday? A whole bunch of checks went out to people that were deceased.
I heard about it. Not surprising.
That can't. I can't. You know, this is my government sucks right here. Before they went out with checks, they didn't check to see who was still alive, and they just mailed out the check based on tax information. Got to do better, y'all. Got to do better. Rant time here, folks, and this will trigger a few people. So let me get this straight. Jimmy Kimmel has a crisis of conscience all of a sudden, and so does Hollywood now, where it comes to their racist history, including their wearing a blackface. Oh, really? So when was this the case? You know, I remember back in the 90s when Ted Danson wore blackface in front of Whoopi Goldberg and a bunch of other people. Very little outrage happened from the Hollywood community. Matter of fact, he got a really good sitcom on CBS for it. I mean, fuck me. My own governor and attorney general both of them into wearing blackface well back in the 80s. And although some were outraged, deep down, some people in political circles were saying, as long as it doesn't cause a cosmic shift, it's okay for this to happen. No, it was not okay. It still is not okay. You see, folks, this old school attitude about the racist use of blackface isn't old at all, nor is Hollywood's denial of saying one thing and doing another. There used to be minstrel shows back in the 30s or the 50s where people either wore blackface that were Caucasian or African American that wore blacker faces. But now, all of a sudden, Hollywood has decided to act woke about not only the environment, but social issues as well. And honestly, it's going to backfire because people know, well, Hollywood's full of shit when it comes to their remorse and their racist attitudes. It goes beyond blackface, though, believe that. You see, they live in an isolation bubble, basically, with celebrities. Because they come in, they see one thing, do the complete opposite. A lot of celebrities aren't comfortable with talking about race or issues surrounding the African-American community as they live in a nice isolation chamber of sorts. Here's something that people don't want you to hear. Hollywood, compromised, it's mainly brought up white liberals that are racist as hell deep down and want nothing to do with African-Americans except for the ones they work with. I remember back on KYSR, which at the time was Hot Adult Contemporary, which is now Alternative. Back in late 2000, early 2001 time period, Jamie Lee Curtis was talking about book drive. I'm like, well, this is a good thing. Child literacy, this is a good thing. Then the other shoe dropped, Brentwood's, where it was being held. Excuse the fuck out of me. Not Watts, not East LA, not Echo Park, not downtown LA, Compton. Where it's mainly rich white people for the most part, or the well-to-do. Jay and Nicole Brown Simpson, they lived in Brentwood, but you get the idea, it's mainly a rich enclave in Brentwood and predominantly white. Now, Hollywood has this nice little scheme. Come out, lecture us, the people, outside their isolation chambers on issues they want us to believe they care about, then turn around, do the opposite. Happens every year. Grammys, Golden Globes, Oscars, Tonys if you're Broadway, or the Emmys. Unless it's Denzel Washington, Spike Lee, or if you're white, Ed Begley Jr., it's basically full of shit what you get from Hollywood and shit in, shit out, basically. Ed Begley Jr. actually backs up what he says about the environment, and I give him full credit for that. I don't agree with something he has to say, but unlike a lot of politicians and celebrities, I admire that he backs up his words with actions. For that, I give him props. Denzel Washington, Spike Lee, despite them being African-Americans, they rightly back up what they say with actions. People like Ed, Denzel, and Spike, I admire. They back up what they say instead of most celebrities. So why do they do that? Why do they act like this? Well, it's because they want to feel important about what they're trying to speak on. They want to be like Sally, who, after doing Places of the Heart, decided to lecture people on stage about the hardships of working on a farm. You had celebrities back in the early 90s that did ads from the National Resource Defense Council trying to tell us who didn't support this cause, you didn't care about the environment, you were stupid and ignorant. A lot of them were basically pissed also at Ricky Gervais for what he said this year in his monologue at the Golden Globes. But then I pissed him because Ricky was lying. He was telling the truth, and it was a nonstop red pill fest. Ricky told the truth. That's why they're pissed. They're pissed because they realized, oh, God, He's airing out our dirty laundry. Yeah, he did. Brilliantly, I might add. Goes like this. Hollywood needs to stop lecturing us on race, the environment, politics, etc. They need to stop. They have no idea what happens in the real world outside of their isolation chambers that they exist in. And it's time for us, we the people, to wake up and stop calling Hollywood
like
the time of day.
He should be hurried back on. Just remember, we have other shows on True Radio Network. So make sure you tune in each day to see what's on our True Radio Network show.
Yeah, but it's time for people to just wake up.
Dan is having some technical difficulties.
That's weird.
He's signing back on.
Okay. Here we go. Next week, we're doing, in the basement, we're doing Stephen King, Katara. We're doing one of our favorite authors. Are you there? Okay. Okay, let's try this again. Next week, we're doing Stephen King. And hopefully Blog Talk won't mess us up with this one, because we're doing all 31 works that I've seen of his work that have been adapted, including Dr.
Stand
Sleep.
By.
Katara, you there? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and cut this off because of technical difficulties. Y'all have a great week, and we will see you next week from the basement. Take care, everyone. Yeah.